Thanks. There we go. So this is a piece called Ear Trumpet. So there's a lot to be said and very little time to say it, which seems to me, just 12 minutes, which seems to me to start with to be one of the prime virtues of poetry, or at least of the poetry I think I want to practice, its intensity. Vertu, not its near homonym virtue, once meant in Geoffrey Chaucer's urbane Middle English something like strength or intensity, or maybe life force. April rain showers, say the famous opening lines of his big prologue, have bathed every vein in switch liqueur of which vertu engendered is the fleur. Closer to us, Dylan Thomas translates and refigures vertu almost as famously as force. You know this line, the force that through the green fuse drives the flower. When I first heard Thomas reading that exact poem on LP, checked out from a public library in Truro, Nova Scotia for 2 weeks when I was 15, in the midst of my own green age, I began, I'm sure now, to feel that force, that intensity, not simply as a kind of pubescent, sappy, eroticized nature, but as something more essentially verbal, as a particular sort of audible wetness, a mouth music. I liked how he sounded. I have a story. I was once in a bar with Don McKay. This sounds like a repurposed Al Purdy story, but it isn't. He was around then, though. Don was my teacher, and I was a graduate student at Western. The bar was an ersatz English pub called Chaucer's in London, Ontario. This was a while ago, at a point in my life when I know I was consistently trying too hard. I was trying to impress Don by telling him spiffy things about poetry, and he was politely listening to whatever it was I was saying. I somehow got onto Dylan Thomas, whom I knew Don had written about. I thought I might impress him with my newfound graduate student dismissiveness, which I believed he might take for a sign of burgeoning critical acumen. I made some offhand remark about all that Dylan Thomas shit. I actually meant it as a kind of compliment to Thomas, a sort of punky streetwise argot, which for some reason seemed appropriate to me. Now that I reiterate it, having just said it out loud, it's more or less just shameful. And that's pretty much how I said it. Shit. As soon as the words left my mouth, I knew I had miscalculated. So, Don set his beer down, gently, and still looking at his glass, said calmly, "Well, I wouldn't say that." At that moment, I think I learned two important things. First, you shouldn't pretend to say things you don't mean. And second, the poets I admire take poetry, all poetry, seriously. It's something like an article of faith to them. I want to say to us, but I can't quite. Those poets tend to mean what they say. Jane Cortez, the African-American poet, says that saying what you mean, that voice, is a matter of putting your mouth on paper, which is an idea I like plenty. But I also think that voice is a matter of lifting your mouth off the paper again, and of maybe having a little bit of yourself, a little slaver, say, left behind. Phonic fibrils, a dissolute salivary ink. Voice is a species of contact or exchange, fleshed out liminally and even awkwardly across a page. Swapped spit, an embouchure. This poem I'm going to read, Embouchure, opens a collection of the same name, which is a sequence of historically minded impersonations of jazz trumpeters from the early 20th century. For me, this poem lays claim to a kind of embodied poetic. So, embouchure. You get as good lip service as you give. Chops will ever out the fake, the put-on line. Never cut grace notes from a sloppy wad of clams. Trued up, a well-flubbed phrase ought to betray nothing more than lacquered horn, the schwa blat of hand-polished open brass. Style takes care of its own. Chops make the rep. An off mouthpiece can cut you like shrapnel. Know the hard limits of your instrument and work its righteous edges. Be the pro. Then come the call, let rip a proper lick. Commit. Now it seems like this poem might just be about the difficulty of playing a trumpet, which is a notoriously hard instrument from which to get a deliberate or workable sound, and on which to find something like a voice. But this poem's actually more or less about how I think I want to write. It feels to me like whether or not you can finish it out, the poetic gesture begins, as this poem ends, with a specific commitment. As Charles Wright puts it in his elegy to another trumpet player, Miles Davis, we need to confront those two dark syllables, begin, as syllables, and to commit to the verbal arc of line, of strophe, of page, mouth to mouth. As we've been hearing, maybe, commitment often has its politics, hazy though they may sometimes be. My other main source of poetic drive and of its cultural politics when I was an adolescent was Joe Strummer. It was The Clash. I like music. When Jacqueline was convening this panel over email, she suggested we read new work. Here's an unpublished narrative piece called The Clash Takes Carisdale, which is, as you might be able to hear, also a response to some other forebears whom I try to take seriously and at their world. The Clash played the Cyclone Taylor Arena. So it's called The Clash Take Carisdale, 26th of June, 1982. With Topper sacked, Paul and Mick wouldn't stop bickering backstage like a pair of married wanks. The whole set pretty much sucked now. When Joe snarled career opportunities into his taped up mic, nobody in the makeshift mosh pit looked as if they'd ever get wise to the in-joke. Four self-styled punk rock warlords who'd eviscerate all comers from naff dandies to mohawked hypocrites, slagging the replicant rock stars they couldn't help becoming even if they'd wanted to. They talked the roadies and stagehands into scrawling the band's last will and testament in red spray paint on a backdrop of quilted flags they had suspended from the arena rafters, beside the minor league pennants and mock-up of local hockey jock Cyclone Taylor's retired jersey. A graffiti patchwork of song titles like Clash City Rockers, Safe European Home, Jail Guitar Doors, and Police on My Back, the greatest hits they never had and never thought they would. When Mick asked, should I stay or should I go, they all knew the answer. A Carisdale skating rink somewhere in white bread West Coast Canada was no substitute for the Hammersmith Palais. True to form, Joe finished by mouthing off about the art of politics, the politics of art. Each show like this left them less sure they'd ever changed the world. The point for me isn't the despair of quietism, but to confront poetically the very possibility of commitment, this time as a poetic article of faith, but of a very particular kind. Art and the planet tell us, P.K. Page writes in her Simon Fraser convocation address, change your life. She's translating Rilke's archaic torso as he attends to his own artistic imperative. But if you look to the original German, I'm going to fake pronounce this, du musst dein Leben ändern, the poet's demand is not only that we change poetically, but also more literally that we live otherwise. You must make yourself other than who you are. And it's that otherwise, the discomfiting of self and of voice, that haunts me, both as an earful of gentle shame and as a mouthy plenitude. It's what makes me want to write. That's it.